The rain in Spain falls mainly on the plain.
That is a menacing Liza Doolittle. Hi, Mage fans. This is your host, Terry Robinson, and my distinguished guest today is Matthew Dawkins, in-house developer for Onyx Path Publishing and the developer for World of Darkness. Matthew, how you doing?
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, Terry. No, it's distinguished. That's something that doesn't often get thrown around in my direction.
Well, as the editor, I introduce everyone as distinguished, and then I remove it in post. That way everyone feels special. It's just one of the little things I do. So what is an in-house developer or a World of Darkness developer? Like, what's the difference between a developer and a writer when it comes to World of Darkness games?
Well, the in-house developers at Onyx Path Publishing are myself, Dixie Cochran, and Eddie Webb. We oversee various lines, and they don't all make sense, those groupings. Mine tend to be the World of Darkness games. Dixie oversees the Exalted and Chronicles of Darkness games, and Eddie... We often just say Eddie has everything else, but that's because he handles the majority of the story path games, which is our new system that's being used for games like They Came From Beneath the Sea, Scion, Trinity, Dystopia Rising. But he also has games such as Pugmire, Legend Lore, and a whole bunch of others. Now, sometimes that role requires us to develop books personally. Sometimes it means we hire developers to develop those books for us, and developers in turn hire writers to write those books. So the developer role is, I guess, what I've been doing most of in my time as a freelance RPGist. That tends to involve writing an outline for a book, assigning various sections to various writers, and overseeing their project work. As they turn work in, you redline it, which is to say you go through it, you comment on what needs changing, what is already perfect, what needs removal. And the reason it's called redlining is because if you were doing it by hand, you would theoretically be using a red pen. And then the writers do a final draft. They turn that into the developer, and at that point it's up to the developer to make sure all chapters that have been submitted are consistent, of good or better quality, and if they're not, the developer has to fill in any blanks by writing them themselves. So as an in-house developer, I oversee a whole bunch of that across games such as Vampire the Masquerade, World of the Apocalypse, Mage of the Ascension, and the other well-known World of Darkness games.
So are you also the person who is then producing ideas for a new book? So if someone wanted there to be a Mage the Ascension Book of the Deep Umbra, which doesn't exist, is that an idea that would originate with you, or would a writer pitch that to you, or does that come from somewhere else and then you develop an outline? Where do the book ideas come from?
Well, that could be either way. To be quite honest, I could come up with a book concept, but I'm always more than happy to receive pitches from writers, from developers, or even fans, as long as they're submitted in the correct format, which is via the Onyx Path website. We've got guidelines on the website on theonyxpath.com. And the reason I say that, it isn't me just being mired in bureaucracy, it's because we need to sign up to non-disclosure agreements when we send pitches in, because you may send a pitch in today and it may not get turned into a book for 3 years' time. But once you've made the pitch, you're basically agreeing this pitch belongs to the company. Now, in an ideal world, the person that makes the pitch will then have an active role on the book. So, for instance, if you, Terry, were to make a pitch for your book about the Deep Umbra and Mage of the Ascension, I would hope to hire you on in some capacity to work on that book. Sometimes it doesn't work that way. Maybe it's because a fan has pitched it and that fan has no writing experience, or indeed no interest in writing, or maybe even no interest in consulting. Or maybe a developer pitches it and that developer has actually got a lot of tight deadlines on another project. And so we won't just take their idea and run away with it. We'll discuss it with them. We'll explain why we won't be working with them, but thank you very much. And that is the way it goes.
Interesting. So does that require you to then have encyclopedic understanding of all the old World of Darkness lines? Or is it a case where you have a research period before you start a new text? How do you keep up to date on the fact that everything is kind of interwoven?
Well, that's actually a really good question. I don't think I've ever been asked about that before. And it is really quite tricky, especially with the World of Darkness. I would say this is why I am the in-house developer of the World of Darkness above Eddie and Dixie, because while Eddie especially has worked on the World of Darkness for a very long time, I have a more encyclopedic knowledge of that game setting, which means the level of research I need to do before I start work on a book, whether it's outlining it or writing on it myself, is comparatively short compared to someone else that's brought on board. Now, I can say that with some confidence when it comes to vampire, werewolf, wraith, and even changeling. Mage, however, obviously the subject of this podcast, is a wholly different animal. Because it has, much like vampire and werewolf, been through the full gamut of editions, and some of those editions have varied wildly in the direction of the game, but that hasn't rendered any of the meta plot, I guess, non-canonical, the sheer amount of information you need to retain in your head to adequately portray Mage in a way that established fans expect is really quite challenging. And I would say that that's one of the reasons Satyros Phil Brocato has been such a mainstay on the line. He is a fantastic inventor of concepts. He has a marvelous creative mind, and I love working with him whenever I get the opportunity to, because he manages to produce content that no one else seems capable of. But also, he knows Mage in and out. And there are very few people in this industry who can say the same thing. Very few indeed. And that means even if Phil wants a break from a book, we have to drag him back and do another one, because there aren't that many people who can do it. And I'll give you an example, because some people have come to me before and said, hey, why don't you start this book up? And why don't you contact, let's say, Jesse Heinig to develop that book? Now, I know Jesse is an incredibly talented developer and writer, but I also know that Jesse oversaw an edition of Mage the Ascension that, due to historical fan wars between editions, not everyone be amenable to. That's not to say Jesse is unhireable, far from it, but it does mean I would have to be very careful where I would assign someone like Jesse, or indeed if Jesse even wanted to work on another Mage book. So the assignment of people, whether it's related to their pitches, related to their knowledge, is a bit of a, I guess, tactical or strategic. It requires a bit of strategic nuance, as you really have to put the right people on the right books. And if you do need someone to do research before they start working on a book, you need to really build that in to their deadlines. You can't just say, have a month to write 30,000 words. Oh, and by the way, it's about the traditions. Because that, in theory, should be the simplest thing of all. Write about the playable classes, for want of a better word, in Mage the Ascension. That's information that's accessible to everybody. But if one of those traditions is, for instance, the Order of Hermes, which is arguably the most storied tradition in Mage the Ascension, the amount of knowledge that you need about the Hermetics is quite vast, and how much of it you cut, how much of it you can make anew, is really quite challenging, and I think quite daunting to a new writer. It's certainly been daunting to me as a in-house developer of Mage the Ascension, because I am fully aware that if I was to write up the history of the Order of Hermes, I wouldn't just have to read the tradition books for the Order of Hermes to get that. I would have to be looking across a vast number of source books. Otherwise, I know full well there will be fans who have read those books who say, why didn't you mention this war with the Tremere in the 18th century or equivalent?
Yeah, why didn't you mention the first Misasa War or what have you? And to our listeners, Jess Hennig was the lead author, developer, apologies if I'm using the wrong term, for Mage the Ascension Revised, which in my opinion is one of the tightest rule sets that Mage has ever had, but introduced the Avatar Storm, the departure of the Masters, the victory of the Technocracy, and a number of other metaplot changes that are very divisive. In my opinion, Mage 20 handled that well with saying, you can pick any of these, and M20 is a love letter to the fans' toolbox approach that is encyclopedic in terms of its contents. You can run with any of those. We're not really advancing the metaplot in this edition, but that is background on who Jess Hennig is. Now,
oh yeah, it's going to be a very interesting question, in fact. When Mage 5th Edition inevitably comes out, what direction White Wolf, Paradox, and whomever gets to develop that core rulebook decides to go. And I say that, and this is purely theoretical on my part. It's not, got nothing to do with me, what Paradox decide to do. But if, let's say, they want Mage of the Ascension to be more street level, like they have done with Vampire 5th Edition, there's certainly a strong argument to making it more like the revised Mage of the Ascension, where the traditions are very much on the losing end of things, where the technocracy is pernicious and everywhere. But we also know that that isn't what the established fan base are necessarily all going to want. So yeah, that's going to be a challenge, probably more so than any other World of Darkness game line, how to appease the mage fans with a brand new edition, not just a big compilation edition like Mage 20.
I feel no strong urge to have it be a continuation of what's come before. Obviously, this is personal opinion. If Mage 5th Edition goes in a radically different direction, I still have literally the 94 books that have already been published that I can still use at my game table. And if it goes in a radically different direction, either setting-wise, great, I have new setting I can play with, or radically different direction rules-wise, then great, I may have streamlined rules to run with. Now, you worked on what I consider to be one of the best books ever produced in Old World of Darkness, Beckett's Jihad Diary, and I wish there were a mage analog. And that is a giant book of metaplot. Do you consider writing large shifts in metaplot to be fundamentally different in terms of how you approach it versus maybe filling out a book on how a city operates or coming up with a new faction that is operating in whatever the central conflict of a game line is? Or is metaplot just another thing that you have to write as a writer?
Well, I love metaplot, and that may put me on the wrong side of history, I don't know. But I think that metaplot is a fantastic tool for storytellers and players alike, and Vampire 5th Edition goes some way to allowing players to incorporate metaplot into their character backgrounds with lore sheets, and I hope to see similar things in Werewolf 5th and Mage 5th. But anyway, in terms of my, I guess, writing philosophy and the way I approach metaplot system settings and so on, it's going to be a fairly dull answer, but no, I don't really have a different approach to it, because my driving idea when it comes to every single book I have developed, and I put this in almost all of my outlines, is I want utility. I want these books to provide players and storytellers with options. And that means, as I write in my outline, I want there to be a story hook in every single sentence or every couple of sentences, if possible. And it can be subtle, it can be blatant. But even if I'm writing out skills or attributes in a book, I want them to be so evocative that players want to use them. And that sometimes that's a big push. Sometimes that sounds a bit silly. But even especially with metaplot, metaplot should be there as fuel for the imagination. And I think the same thing if I was doing a city sourcebook like Chicago by Night. If I'm detailing the O'Tolly's restaurant that's just off the New Jersey Turnpike, I want werewolf players to pull their bikes over at the O'Tolly's, grab a burger, and I want to know what the O'Tolly's looks like. I want to know something hidden about that O'Tolly's restaurant, such as O'Tolly's is a Pentex subsidiary, which it is. And so it goes throughout everything that I either write or develop. I think utility is the most important thing in any RPG, more so than colorful, flavorful text, more so than even streamlined rules, because streamlined rules are fantastic. I love them. But there's no substitute, to my mind, for something that can grab a new storyteller, a new GM, a new player, and make them think, I really want to play with this. I have an opinion, and this is based on the fact that I came into gaming probably playing with D20 and GURPS more than anything else. And I'm not saying they are the best systems in the world, but I have the attitude that I learned to play with very crunchy systems. And I still go back and play with very crunchy systems at times. But the games I play are largely irrespective of the system they use. It really comes down to how interesting, how inspiring those games are. And a game like Mage: The Ascension is arguably infinitely inspiring because there's just so much you can do with it. But at the same time, there's choice paralysis. Mage: The Ascension can be so inspiring, you just have no idea what to do with it. So Mage is a game that would benefit hugely from a Becker's Jihad diary, in my opinion, because you could set off hundreds, thousands of chronicles just from a book full of these story hooks.
Yeah, my hope was always that there would be an Amanda Jensen's Ascension diary or some analog or journal to avoid using the same term twice. So you have made mention of a number of games and the other games that you are working on. I feel as if Old World of Darkness is somewhat strange in that it is urban fantasy, which almost of necessity is going to be somewhat contemporary. And the world has changed a fair bit over the last 25 years, but in a lot of critical ways, the setting itself hasn't, and it takes these large breaks to shift. Do you feel that there are fundamental changes that a storyteller needs to bring into their game to keep the Old World of Darkness relevant? Like, one of the neat things that Beckett's Jihad Diary, not to bang on too much about a system that isn't Mage, one of the things it does in the back is it talks about how the different editions are different, the way they have different themes and different ideas, that Gehenna is close versus it is more of something that is whispered in dark shadows, or the idea of vampirism as sexuality or something like that. Is there some analog that you think the other lines could use or that storytellers should have in mind when they say, I understand that this was the viewpoint when these games were created, 25 years have passed, I need to update the World of Darkness in this way? Or do you see a way in which you feel that the Old World of Darkness doesn't quite still serve as a satire and a parody as maybe it was once intended?
Well, I think the World of Darkness very much became more power fantasy than it did human tragedy. And human tragedy is, again, arguably what the first editions were all about, even when it was cranked up urban fantasy like Mage: The Ascension, which one could argue isn't a horror game in the same vein as Vampire and Werewolf, and is probably one of the reasons so many people compared to Vampire struggle to understand Mage and its place within World of Darkness, Changeling as well. That's not to say it's all light and baubles, but it's a very interesting kind of horror that takes a fair amount of study to wrap your head around. Now, in terms of whether it's relevant and whether it needs adaptation, I think it certainly does need to be adapted to the modern era, because that 90s ethos of what horror was, what these where these games were sat, I guess, in the market and in everyone's popular consciousness, would be different now because of current modern day politics, which I think most people would agree is, if you don't pardon my French, is fucking awful. And it doesn't really matter which side of the divide you come down on in that regard. I think the fact that there is just such a strong divide right now between left and right, between this view and that view, means that everything is so much on the verge of explosion. It feels like that. And it didn't necessarily feel that way with the World of Darkness as it was originally presented, which was more of a slow burn. So you have a zeitgeist now, to use a very popular term, that is certainly different to the power fantasies of playing a member of the Camarilla, or a member of the Get of Fenris, or a member of the Order of Hermes, which is all about building up in power, building up in influence. Because back then, becoming the Wolf of Wall Street, or to be more 90s about it, becoming Michael Douglas, is making yourself into king shit now. You're the bad guy. Whereas nowadays, you're kind of on the street again. You are struggling to make ends meet. You're struggling to find a place in a world that is quickly escaping you. And I'm just talking about the human experience, let alone the mage or vampire experience. So in a lot of ways, it returns to where Vampire Mage and Werewolf started in the early 90s. But there is clearly difference, and I think that's the reason the fifth edition will revolutionize the games. And when I use a term like revolutionize, I don't mean pick apart to the nth degree, but there comes a time when culture changes, when society changes, that our media changes as well, whether it's what we're watching on TV, whether it's what we're listening to. I mean, hell, think about all the dance that we were listening to in the early 90s. That kind of music isn't being made now. And so RPGs have to change too. The settings we're playing in have to change if they're to remain at all relevant. And that's part of the reason games companies should make new editions, even all the money question aside, because I'm sure all games companies want more money. New editions make a great deal of sense. And yeah, I think Mage is due one in a year or two.
Is there a fundamental theme of Mage that you feel in a M5, you feel if you were asked to be lord over it, that would become front and center again? One of the things that I've always felt curious in the world of darkness is there are exceedingly few good institutions. There are good people and there are bad actors, but it seems that most accumulations of power are going to be negative, almost of necessity, to make it so that individual action can be potent. But I feel as if in the 21st century, the realization that a single person acting alone may not be enough requires the institutionalist versus, let's say, more autonomous view of power to become front and center. Is there any theme that you feel that would need to come forward again? Or do you feel that there are groups or organizations that would need to be changed or revitalized in a more contemporary view of the Mage, the Ascension setting?
Well, that is a fantastic question, because Mage has more factions, more groups with desire for influence over the world. And let's keep in mind that mages are all about influence, whether they want to be or not. If belief governs reality, they're... Well, consensus governs reality. If you listen to the other side, that's a very scary topic. And so, yeah, as I was saying, I think you can very easily fall into the revised method of looking at technocracy as supreme, the traditions on the way out. I think that's a little too black and white for 2019 and beyond. I think it would make a great deal of sense even to cleave to some canon and go with the fact that you could say the Ascension War happened, or some manner of Ascension happened, and a lot of mages have moved on, transcended, done whatever it is, and now only appear in astral realms, because it clears the ground for new heroes and new struggles. And I don't mean to parrot Vampire too much with its beckoning and all the elders and Methuselahs, or most of them, traveling to some mysterious place to do battle with some mysterious enemy. But I think it did a hell of a lot of good for Vampire to remind the players that their characters are front and center, that the coterie of 13th generation vampires is now a very powerful thing if they can stick together and work together. So if you imagine that I know I keep picking on the poor old Order of Hermes, but if you imagine that that structure is completely dilapidated, that they've lost so many of their archmages and they are picking through the ruins and having to relearn all about structure or make a new structure that is relevant for tonight, I think that fuel story. Again, you are putting tools in players' hands, not just presenting them with a hierarchy that has been present for hundreds of years, unchanged. You're now saying there's gaps in that hierarchy. You can fill them through your deeds. And that may mean toppling some traditions. It may mean revitalizing others. But I think more than anything, it means you would have more and more orphans, more and more hollow ones and so on, but without direction, without leadership, without tradition. Because traditions in 2019, if we're looking at our world, are on the way out. This is a time where things are increasingly changing, and I would say even escaping the grips of the technocracy. If you want to use a god-awful example like the current president of the United States, think of Trump as a media personality who didn't even want to be president, who was just in it for the bucks and managed to become president in spite of himself, and then thought, hell, I can do this job. You know, I'll do this job well. I'll be the best at this job, and other such Trumpisms. Now, I can well imagine a technocratic, an arm of the technocracy, an arm of the union, such as the Syndicate, even the NWO, propping up someone like Trump just to put their man in the White House, because these politicians are too ideological. And this guy is clearly in it for himself. He's clearly able to be a puppet. But then they lose control of him. And he takes control of the media. He takes control of public perception. And he's not awakened. He's not a mage. He has no power. And yet he does have power. He does create consensus through his own actions, his own mundane sleeper actions. And I think that would be terrifying to the technocracy when they realize that they have lost grip on the power of technology. They didn't foresee Twitter being a tool of magic in this way. And yet this disgusting man has somehow been able to do it, and he's unassailable.
Oh, yeah. It just kind of sounds like you're positing a world where, one, the sleeper becomes central again in a way mm-hmm. that it seemed like V5 was very much a reminder that there are 7 billion people out there. Yes. And if you screw up, they too can exert your role. And now you have this humbler technocracy that even if they are technologically 50 years in advance, they don't have the ability to control every Twitter mob on the face of the planet. They can't control Facebook, where at the same time, some other event occurs that doesn't necessarily constrict reality, almost does the opposite. And suddenly we realize that the power structures we had before are not working, and the players get to be on the ground floor of whatever comes next.
Yeah, I almost like the idea, and I know this is a lot of focus on the technocracy now, but a lot of people love them. For some inexplicable reason, I guess they're cool. It's not really inexplicable. I think there's a lot about the technocracy to love, but to my mind, they are anti-heroes at best, and that really is at best. I think a lot of technocratic views are wholly alien to the human experience. But that aside, I would like to think of some high-powered syndicate mage looking at Twitter and Facebook, looking at the kind of retweets and likes someone like Trump gets with one of his vile diatribes, and all the bots and all the humans agreeing with him and waving flags about children being locked up in cages on the border. And they're thinking, this is more vulgar than anything we could possibly do. This sheer vulgarity of using a tool like this and somehow making all these people fall in line. Why can they not see it? Why can they not see through it? If we tried something like this with our talents, we would be turned inside out by Paradox.
So you mean vulgar in the mage sense there?
Oh, it's vulgar okay. In both senses, I think.
Just checking.
It's the kind of thing that, for all their technological advancement, I love this idea that the technocracy they may well be ahead of in terms of technological development, but they are probably not so far ahead in terms of sleeper society, sleeper consensus, sleeper expectation. And that means that basically what the technocracy are doing is creating their own kind of vulgarity, because they're creating technology people don't want to use. People are too lazy to go along with what the union want. They are quite happy to follow this plumped up little autocrat in the White House and do whatever horrible things he says. But yeah, I'll get off my political high horse. I've actually been very kind to that abomination of a man.
If the standard we use is Satoros, and that is a 10 on that scale, you're registering at about a 0.5.
I think
you're good in that regard. So you would posit a world to just try to encapsulate that, where is it safe to say that you see an M5 where, as we know it, the technocracy has kind of lost control. We're on a spectrum in first edition Mage. All of human history since the Renaissance was basically a technocratic conspiracy. And then in 2E, they kind of lose control. And then in 30/revised, that iron grip comes back. In 4E, it's more of a conversation about the corruption of power. And in 5th, it is losing control of that sleeper narrative writ large.
Yeah, I think that works for me. Let's write it. But no, in the...
I just don't want to misrepresent you and...
That works for me. I think the biggest challenge with that idea, to my mind, is that it becomes too bleak a setting. There always needs to be hope, especially in Mage the Ascension. But that then causes the kind of thing that I really love in a game, which is the old He-Man and the Masters of the Universe Christmas special, where Skeletor and He-Man have to team up to beat Hordak. And in this game, it's traditions and technocracy having to team up to actually start creating a little bit of wonder in the world again. And that's not to say, because that can get quite closely into changing the dreaming territory, so I think there still needs to be some division. But I think characters starting off on the back foot, even in a urban fantasy game like Mage, is a nice way to say you are cursed to know more than anyone else. You can do things that would bewilder and blow the minds of the mundane individual. But if there's a lot of them, they're just going to look straight through you. They are not going to believe what you're doing. And I think that there's a certain great, I guess, synthesis of Mage the Ascension with the way things like technology has blown up. Again, if you look at 3rd edition and 4th edition with Power Corrupt, as even just the rise of the internet in the late 90s and early 2000s, there was still a certain amount of wonder to that, as people were becoming addicted to it, as people were learning all of the things they could do by communing with people all over the world. But a tool like that is too great for even just the technocratic union to wield. It became a tool of the sleepers, and now that they don't have it anymore, what are they going to do next? Are they going to try and take it back? Or are they going to try and dismantle it surreptitiously because they are increasingly becoming obsolete themselves? That's what I would do. But I should hasten to add, I'm not at this time overseeing M5, so we'll have to see what happens.
Understood. My final question regarding a notional M5 is a mechanical one. Do we need to get rid of the profusion of focuses, instruments, and paradigms? Do you feel that's an impediment to new players playing the game? I was having a conversation with someone associated with LA by Night, and they said the fundamental problem with Mage is people see the other World of Darkness games, and then they see Mage, and they say to themselves, I want to be a wizard in an urban fantasy setting that gets to cast cool spells. Mage doesn't let you do that in any reasonable amount of time, and understanding the rules is something that is on the order of completing a master's degree. Do you think that would need to be swept away?
No, actually. I'm a pretty big fan of how the Mage system is set up, and as an example, I'm sure a lot of people have pointed it out, the hunger system in V5 lends itself perfectly to, well, almost perfectly, to rage in Werewolf and Paradox in Mage, if you make Paradox a more present threat. But the biggest secret, I guess, the biggest open secret to how to get around the Mage system restrictions when it comes to spell casting, to be quite frank, is for every player to create a spellbook. And this is something I haven't seen done often, and I never learned to do this by reading a book. of Mage, I just started telling players to do this, because obviously you start combining your spheres, you come up with some wonderful new spell based off your own imagination, and expecting players to recall those things or organically come up with spells on the fly and not just study the spheres for 5 minutes before saying, I'm going to turn this this railing into a boa constrictor to get a bit beetle juicy. What you can do instead is every single player has a notepad or a lovely journal from the Onyx Paths Redbubble store. There's a plug. With their tradition symbol on it. And whenever they create a spell, they record it in their spellbook. And it's an out-of-character prop or an in-character prop or both. And they put sphere plus sphere equals bleh, and they say what it was, at which point they can refer back to it whenever they want. And if they particularly want to dress that journal up, make it into a lovely prop that they could take it to a live action roleplay or just put on their shelf and say, this is from that fantastic Mage Chronicle I ran, then excellent. It's a similar issue I come up against in Story Path and the Age system. So going outside of Onyx Path for a second to Green Ronin with the Age system is the concept of stunts. And these, in fact, they come up in Exalted too, where you have a book full of powers that you're supposed to use when you get an excess number of successes. You can use those excess successes to buy a stunt. And stunts can be made up on the fly, or you can refer to the book. But I find so many players just don't bother, because not everyone owns the book, and even those who do don't want to flick through it. And I think the same goes for Mage. So get them to write it down themselves. They will remember it as they write it. And even if they don't, they'll be able to refer back to it in their own hand and feel special about the fact that they've created their own spellbook. I love the idea of every single Mage having their own spellbook, and then the risk of what happens if you lose it. I think a wonderful prop that you can introduce that makes the Mage system a hell of a lot simpler.
Okay, so almost literal bookkeeping in the sense of each player creates a grimoire of some sort.
Yeah, you're a Mage, for God's sake. Act like it.
Write this shit down. Bring sticky notes into the field. So that was a lovely 40-minute side jag into an initial question on a tentative M5, which I just assumed you would be unable or unwilling to talk about. So that was delightful. But outside of the traditional Old World of Darkness, you are also working on another game that I am very much looking forward to see being released onto the world. They Came From Beneath the Sea. It's They Came From Beneath the Sea, not It Came From Beneath the Sea.
You are correct. It Came From Beneath the Sea is a B-movie, and well, appropriately enough, They Came From Beneath the Sea is the RPG.
What is the contrivance of this game, and what do you feel are the new systems that it implements that may differentiate it from what an Old World of Darkness player may be used to seeing?
Well, its central conceit is a B-movie sci-fi, 1950s Americana, very idealized, very happy days. Everyone's a greaser with a hot rod or works in a diner. They drink dollar shakes. They go to the drive-in and watch a movie there. But unlike the Red Menace, you have a Green Menace, and it is crawling up the shore to invade your perfect small 1950s American town. Now, that's very simple on the face of it. It's perfect for a one-shot, but the deeper level of this, past the veneer of it, is where you can turn the game horrific or humorous. And if you want to take it horrific, yeah, that is a thinly cloaked reference to the Red Scare in the 1950s. McCarthyism. McCarthy does show up in the book. He gets eaten by a giant clam, but we can get back to that if needs be. The larger, I guess, focus of the game is humor. And as an aside, I'll say this. It took me quite a long time to see They Came From as a comedy game, and that's in part because when I first came up with They Came From Beneath the Sea, I was basing it on some dystopian future, part XCOM, part Metal Gear, where you were playing private military companies trying to force back aliens that were waking up from the sea and things like that. And it evolved and evolved again and eventually became They Came From Beneath the Sea, that will be out soon. And now, when I was introducing new systems to it, because it uses story path, but it's very much an augmented story path system, which is still D10, still dice pools, and very much more focused on narrative than World of Darkness or Chronicles of Darkness, I should add.
What do you mean by that? More focused on narrative?
So it has a lot of tools in terms of character setup that reward you playing to certain, for instance, aspirations, or rewards you playing your character's origins or your archetype. For instance, your archetype in They Came From Beneath the Sea might be scientist, or it might be everyman, or it could be, G-man. So you're not necessarily just gaining bonuses for rolling well. You're gaining bonuses. You're being rewarded in this game by playing the character that you have written in a narrative way, in a movie-like way. And I guess to get back to my point, I was seeing They Came From as a genre game. I was seeing it as a movie genre game, and that if I was to do another They Came From game, let's say a Western, They Came From, they
Beyond
came
the
after... Yeah, they came from beyond the hills, they came at high noon, that sort of thing. It would just be a straight Western. I was seeing that They Came From Beneath the Sea is funny because B-movies are funny. But I've come to reassess that now and think, okay, They Came From games can just be funny. And the reason they can be funny, to get to your point, is largely embedded in the system. So They Came From Beneath the Sea has a few different system features that can allow it to become the most fun game you've ever played. But I have noticed a huge number of people play games and they do it for immersion. They do it because they want to tell a gripping story. They want to feel changed afterwards. They want to feel like they've been involved in a creative exercise. And I say all power to them. It's that's a brilliant thing to do. I love Wraith the Oblivion, and I can't say I've ever come away from Wraith feeling terribly elated. Now, I have, however, noticed there aren't many games that make you laugh throughout play and leave you coming away with a big smile on your face and talking about what fun that was. There are some narrative games like Fiasco, The Extraordinary Adventures of Baron Munchausen, and those are old storytelling games, really, in comparison to a lot of things that have come out. But They Came From Beneath the Sea is a traditional tabletop role-playing game that encourages you. It gives you the tools to be funny. And here's where they come in. For instance, as a movie genre game, B-movie sci-fi, it has a system called cinematics. Now, cinematics are powers that players have access to, not characters. And that's important because your characters are characters in a B-movie. They're not actors playing characters. As far as they know, this is their reality. It is the world they live in, and they're just poor bastards that you're pushing around. The players, though, are essentially all directors. And with cinematics, you can alter the world your characters are living in. For instance, if you have sufficient points, you can buy the cheap set cinematic, which, let's say your character is being hounded by a lobster man. You can't, your bullets cannot penetrate his carapace. He is about to snip you in two. If you use cheap set at that point, your character can run through the wall, you know, just tear through a brick wall. Because the set is cheap. It's a B-movie. It's sci-fi. There doesn't have to be in-universe logic for it. And in fact, you can play the characters incredibly confused that this was even, I guess, permissible. But you will never give a concrete answer for why that happened. Likewise, there's cinematics for a missing reel or a missing scene. So Centipus, the 100-tentacled octopus, is about to devour your boat full of heroes. Now, there is no way you're going to be able to fight Centipus. Centipus is one of the biggest creatures in the game. So you insert a missing scene. Everything cuts to black. You all wake up somewhere else. The players can sense is where you appear. You can never refer directly to what happened in that missing scene. You can make vague references. You can say things in character like, I've never seen someone do that with a pineapple before. But you can't actually say how your characters got away from Centipus. And so there's all kinds of things like that. You can summon a stuntman because your physical stats are lacking. You can, if you forgot your gun in a scene, or let's say you had to rush to confront a gill man and you don't have a weapon on you, you can use a deleted scene to then have a flashback and say and narrate how you picked up a gun at the end of the most recent scene, that kind of thing. And it enables the players to all kind of play like movie directors, all kind of play like editors, like the GM. And you also have quips. Quips are your pithy one-liners, and they can rotate throughout the game, or you can keep the same ones, and the more you use them, the more effective they become, and they can be completely out of place. They can be completely vulgar, to use a mage term, but they, as long as they're entertaining, you get the benefit of using them. So if you have a quip like smells like mama's apple pie, now you could use that when sat in the diner at the very beginning of the game, and that would be a perfectly appropriate place to use it. If you've just shoved your fist through the head of a gill man and you use that quip, smells like mama's apple pie, the other heroes might look at you a bit strangely and never want to eat your mama's apple pie, but it's still an entertaining use of your quip. And then when you are seducing your lady love at the end of the session and you say, smells like mama's apple pie, that's just weird, but it's still entertaining. Now, I use these things as examples because what they do, what cinematics do, what quips do, and a bunch of the other mechanics in the game do, is provide the tools for players to make themselves amusing. Not every single player is a comedian. Not every single player is a ready wit. I'm not. I acknowledge that. And if you have cards that you can play in these games with these catchphrases on, with these cinematics on, it enables you to amuse other people at the table and yourself and not feel cheap for doing so. So it's a way of basically fostering fun at the tabletop. And I don't know why it feels like such an alien concept to just have fun at the table. But so many games I play, I guess, are horror, that something like They Came From Beneath the Sea is a breath of fresh air. And every time I've ran it, whether it's at conventions, oh, it's always fun to run this game at conventions, I should add, because you piss off other players at other tables immensely, because everyone is just laughing throughout the game. And so people come up to your table and want to know what you're playing. People want to know why you're having so much fun. And of course you're having fun, you're playing a game. But it's just an unusual reaction to have at the tabletop. And that to me seems strange.
When I run World of Darkness, my players are laughing regularly because I feel the World of Darkness is not internally consistent enough for its own good. Like, players and the world have to look away at the idea that there are so many vampires killing people constantly that if people didn't bring it up, I would consider that to be breaking type. So my games tend to be funny. Someone in my neighborhood dies every 12 hours due to an opioid overdose. I don't need more darkness to it. So my games go kind of towards the light side. Is there a certain degree to which you feel that a funny role-playing game is almost an act of rebellion?
In a weird way, yes. And but not by design. I wouldn't class myself as any kind of rebel when it comes to being an RPG designer. There are far more designers on the avant-garde than me, but I do think that it's unusual to have a game that is pitched as funny, because I think, and this is the reason I really struggled with the idea of They Came From as a comedy game, comedy is seen as the lowest form of entertainment by a lot of people, critically speaking. When you think of the emotions that can be stirred within you by an RPG, shock, horror, sadness, etc., amusement doesn't tend to be high on the list of objectives. So by making a game that is explicitly that, if you want it to be, I should add, because I'll get into why it can also be an extreme horror game, if you like, I think the objective is new, it's fresh, or at least it hasn't been visited for a very long time. I do agree with you, though, that World of Darkness games should have comedy in, because dark humor is a staple of horror. I mean, even if you take a horror movie I'm a big fan of, something like Dawn of the Dead, the original 1978 version, There are moments in that movie, which is pretty damn bleak, that are either quite incisive or they're just slapstick, where you've got zombies being smashed in the face by custard pies. There's no real reason for it, and some people really feel like at that point of the movie it kind of jumps the shark, not necessarily jumps the shark, but it loses a lot of viewers when the bikers turn up and everything sort of falls to shit. But it kind of highlights the fruitlessness of the entire endeavor. And I don't know, I find that amusing. I find a hell of a lot of horror amusing. And whether it's just to break the mood because everything's got so grim, or whether it's because, yeah, if someone is ran over and killed by an ice cream truck on the block that your vampire preys on, that's quite amusing, especially if it's like a hardcore gangster that's been shooting people up for the last 3 weeks and he gets killed by a runaway ice cream truck. There's, you know, delicious irony, delicious in an ice cream flavor.
I was waiting for that, yeah.
With a flake. But yeah, I think humor is not signposted enough in games. Certainly you get narrators in-game who are talking to the reader in a sort of, and I do it with my videos, you know, a sort of, well, welcome back, little neonate, in a sort of deprecating way. And people find that amusing because that narrator can be rude to you, can say, oh, God, you're late again. And people, it's a mild titter because, ha, 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 the narrator of this book is frustrated with me. But obviously other games do it perfectly well. Paranoia
is one of the few games excellent. Where you can die during character creation, which always pleased me.
Yeah, and Traveller. I think Traveller's second edition, maybe, where you can die during character creation. That was a bizarre feature of that game.
So there are a couple different kinds of humor that you've brought up, and there's a couple of different ways. From how I am hearing you describe they came from, I generally don't read manuscript previews. I just wait for the final darn thing to hit my doorstep, which I think it will in 2024 or something like that. I get monthly emails about it. So it sounds like you are getting humor from, one, there is a fundamental humor that comes from misremembering the past. Nostalgia and stereotype and archetype are fertile ways of lampooning the past, and through that lampooning the present, depending on what elements you get to choose. So we have an element of humor that comes from setting, and we have an element of humor that comes from mechanics. You have these quip cards, and much like Cards Against Humanity, part of the humor comes from the discontinuity that occasionally you just have to play a darn card, and the jarring incongruity is kind of funny, and it gives us that element of farce.
Yes.
Do you feel that humor is introduced into the setting in another way? Do you think it is the voice of the writer within the book? Is there another avenue that you feel humor is coming into that came from besides what I'm going to say is those two, the mechanics and the setting?
I think the writer does, or certainly the narrator in the book, tries to be amusing as well. And your mileage may vary with that because each chapter was written by a different writer, and it's very difficult to moderate lots of different writers' sense of comedy. But I think the core of it is exactly as you pointed out, and you pointed out very well, that the farce is similar in some ways, and I would never actually claim to be anywhere close to the Zucker Brothers in terms of comedy, but Zucker Brothers, Mel Brooksian, where there's just something that doesn't make a great deal of sense, and it's amusing because of that. So it's Frank Drebin in the Naked Gun movie, sat in a bar and asking at the bar for a Black Russian. And you can expect what's going to happen, but instead the waiter just looks at the camera, frowns, shakes his head because he's telling you off. He knows what you're thinking, that what's going to happen next? And he just walks off and you never get your Black Russian. And that's breaking the fourth wall, meta-narrative, I think, meta-gaming. They Came from Beneath the Sea is a meta-game, and there's no way of getting around that. I don't want to. Meta-game is a dirty word in a lot of RPGs, or certainly to the minds of a lot of role players. But to play They Came From, you have to actively meta-game, because your characters do not know what's going on. They don't know these cinematics are being used. They don't know they're in a gaming table session, but you do as the players, and what you're doing is using cinematics and quips and so on to make the game as fun for everyone around the table as you possibly can.
Just to clarify that, so you have the Truman Show where you have some characters who are in a TV show and they don't realize it, or in the Truman Show, a character surrounded by actors. And then one step removed, you have something like John Scalzi's Red Shirts, where characters are characters in a novel. They really have no way of speaking to the novelist, but the novelist can rewrite their world. Is it safe to put they came from in either of those buckets? Because from what it sounds like, it is a case where your characters will never necessarily realize what they are. Like, the purpose of the game is not necessarily to make those quip cards and so on diegetic, so the characters know necessarily what's happening. This is just a sanity check to make sure I'm kind of putting it in the right metafictional bucket.
Well, no, it's interesting you use the word sanity check, the term sanity check, I should say. Because there's an episode of The Twilight Zone, actually, that obviously far predates The Truman Show, where a character is answering the phone, and I remember he goes to his office, he finds his life is falling apart, and his wife wants to leave him, and so on. And it turns out that he is a character in a TV show, and he just doesn't realize it until the very end. And I think you can very easily do that where they came from. I was thinking about that episode. It's an old black and white one. When I was writing They Came From Beneath the Sea, I never wanted it to be The Truman Show. I never wanted it to be you were all actors on a set. And in fact, there is another game called It Came From the Late, 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 Late Show, which is very much like that. That's from the late 80s, early 90s. And that's one that came to my attention after we started development of They Came From Beneath the Sea. But I wanted to give the option, without explicitly calling out, that yes, you can play these characters as hopelessly trapped on a movie set. You can certainly play them as actors who are basically picking up a check. But when you do that, I think you lose something from the use of quips and cinematics. The other route, and the reason sanity check was a good term to use, is I ran They Came From for the fine folks at Red Moon Role Playing, a brilliant actual play podcast.
Who specifically said they had no interest in Mage and had no idea how to play that. I'm going to find you and politely tell you about it at some point. I didn't want that to be menacing. Pardon the aside.
So they mainly deal in horror RPGs, or at least they did when I ran They Came From for them at the beginning of 2019. And so I wrangled a way of making They Came From Beneath the Sea a horror game, and this ended up making its way into the manuscript as well, in a manner. And that was, the game itself stays fundamentally the same. And so they were all sort of small town heroes in Denton, Alabama, on the coast, and various bad things were happening to their 1950s town. But instead of the players playing players, the players were playing great old ones. The characters were still characters, but the great old ones could intervene with things like cinematics, basically their great old one powers, to save their chosen cultists, who were unknowingly chosen to be vessels or avatars of the great old ones. And so instead of quips, you actually had Lovecraftian sort of chanting. You had a Yaya Cthulhu Vatagan, and the characters wouldn't necessarily know where these sounds were coming from, that they were suddenly bellowing this out to save their lives. And then, unlike in a lot of games where they came from, where the character would be completely oblivious to the fact this power had just been used, they would be completely aware that that wall should have not just turned to paper. I should not have been able to understand what that deep one was saying. Yeah. I am aware that time just stopped and I ended up somewhere else. Something has intervened to make this happen. But what is it? And in this case, it was they came from beneath the sea still, because after all, Cthulhu does sleep down there. But every single player, I think we had Cthulhu, Nyarlathotep, and the King in Yellow, in play. And so I made a separate set of rules for how different Great Old Ones might use their characters. So it became a completely different game in a sense, because it's Lovecraftian deities manipulating hapless mortals as they do in a probably a very dismissive way. But maybe they're doing it for fun. Maybe they're doing it because they have some special purpose in mind for them. And as we went on, the characters just increasingly lost connection to their, I guess, stability. So if that's something people are interested in listening to, I certainly recommend checking out with Red Moon Roleplaying. But it's a different take on the game, and you don't need to change a whole hell of a lot of it to make that happen.
So one note, the King in Yellow is Robert W. Chambers.
That's true.
Two, is there a, for the Kickstarter backers, is there something that gives you access to like an old-timey radio voice for the purposes of narrative use, or no? Like, is that a higher level to summon you in on a game to do those like recorded quips?
If people want to summon me in to do them, that's fine. I've got a Patreon, and I'll record their clips for them. This coming in for news at 9.
Yeah, my summer
Green
camp.
Invaders from the sea.
We used to do that with contemporary things, just because you're stuck at a summer camp and have no access to either women or the internet, so you just found weird ways to amuse yourself. So we would do pop culture songs as they were from the 1920s, like, Shanshiringan, and so on. So you have mentioned that there are several correct ways, but maybe one or two optimum ways to play the game from Beneath the Sea. And you mentioned this is how humor is brought in. This is how meta-narrative tools are brought in. How, as an Old World of Darkness player, can we take those, I'm going to say technologies, and port them into our Old World of Darkness games? Is it something where I could come up with quip cards, or is it a thing where I can come up with meta-narrative tools to hand players? And once you do that, how does it involve changing the game? Like, to me, I introduce stunts into Old World of Darkness games because I just like rewarding a player that can come up with a very good explanation of how amazing their character is at something. And as a storyteller, I can now ramp up the difficulty knowing that if the players are sufficiently descriptive, they can always get 2 bonus successes and 2 bonus dice. How does a game change once you add those meta-narrative tools, and how do we bring that into Old World of Darkness?
Well, that was one of my favorite things with Exalted when they first introduced it, the idea of rewarding successful narration, essentially. It's far better than I punch him and it removes 6 hit points. And I think you can incorporate a hell of a lot of meta tools or technologies in World of Darkness, all the way from the montage to the Fade to Black, and some of these already exist in World of Darkness, of course, but you would want to use a lighter hand than a game like They Came From has, because They Came From is quite deliberately ham-fisted. It's supposed to be badly acted. It's supposed to be have characters being pushed around like pawns on a chessboard, whereas vampires may certainly feel that way. But I don't think you should have a missing scene inserted, for instance, to save their lives or existences if they're vampires. There are various cinematics you could still use, but I do think that using meta powers in a World of Darkness game is something that needs to be done with a little more caution. Now, that said, one of my favorite things in StoryPath is the momentum pool, or the rewrites or writer's pool in They Came From Beneath the Sea. And that is when every time you make a failure, you put a token in the pool, and this pool builds up and up and up, and eventually you can use those tokens to do something. Now, in They Came From Beneath the Sea, you can use them to get rerolls, you can use them to buy cinematics, but what you could do in a game of Mage, for instance, is use them to purchase a Paradox Backlash, or just, you know, a Universe Course Correction, if you prefer. And I like to think, again, of movie moments where the big antagonist, or the person you think is going to be the big bad guy, blows himself up while he's proudly holding the bomb and saying, once I plant this on the bus, it'll have to drive at no slower than 13 miles per hour, otherwise it will detonate or whatever. At which point, the villain detonates with the bomb in his hands. You see similar things in the TV show Lost a couple of times, where someone's talking about how careful you have to be with dynamite and then they blow themselves up. It's in Oz, another fantastic TV show, where someone is building a bomb inside the prison of Oz, and the season ends, it's American, with the bomb about to go off, all the prisoners being evacuated, and then it just doesn't. It's a dud. Now, sometimes it's that's not the kind of thing the storyteller is going to think of. Sometimes that coming in from left field is something a player can come up with. And being able to not just give players free rein to do these things, but have some kind of exchange mechanism, such as momentum, a pool of failures that you can then turn into as successes, is, I think, a perfect way of incorporating meta-narrative into a game. Because after all, in a lot of our favorite novels and movies and TV shows, our heroes have got to lose and lose and lose and lose before they win. Otherwise, it wouldn't be interesting. If you were constantly in an upward trajectory, it would be a very dull story. So I think that's the best way of incorporating something from, let's say, Story Path into World of Darkness. It's to give players a reward for losing, because losing often makes a story more interesting.
And in other games, they solve this by giving out experience points for failure. The Cypher system, particularly Invisible Sun, which is one I'm getting into, you get despair. It is a resource when things fantastically don't go your way. Or in Chronicles of Darkness, if your character suffers a beat, a lot of those are not positive events. So you are at least being rewarded with character growth in those cases. And Old World of Darkness doesn't really have that. So to me, momentum requires slightly changing the game, because instead of having one necessarily big encounter, you now need to allow players three or four routes to success as opposed to just banking on one, because momentum kind of depends on some of those avenues just not panning out. Are there other ways that you feel that the thought process of building a story needs to be slightly changed, maybe to incorporate these things?
Well, that's down to the storyteller having a more open mind, to put it simply. It's not just World of Darkness. Chronicles of Darkness does it as well, and Numenera and The Strange, where, hell, any game with a GM or a storyteller, especially when they're new, and that's not to say all new GMs are bad, I'm just saying this is a common way that people will design a game. They will have an end point in mind. They will have a dramatic finale in mind. And sometimes those GMs can become frustrated when that finale is not met, and that will ripple out to hit the players, who will feel like, well, that was a bit anticlimactic. But if you put the power in the players' hands to manipulate that end point with things like momentum, or to a lesser degree, something like stunts, or in Chronicles of Darkness, beats that mean if the characters are laying there battered and bruised with an arm dislocated or something like that, they are going to be more rewarded than the person who has been hiding from the entire event and, you know, firing off their rounds from a sniper rifle. That I think the narrative just becomes stronger in the end. And I use that word a lot, narrative, and that's because I do tend to see RPGs in the same vein as a sprawling story. I guess a lot of people do, but I then like to look back at it and be able to tell that tale. I love it when players come to the table and recap their story for me, and if they do that, I generally give them experience points at the beginning of the session. I do that with Call of Cthulhu. I will allow the people who contribute to the recap to spend their experience points on rolling to see whether their skills increase. If you don't contribute to it, that's absolutely fine. You're not really penalized. You've still got your experience. You just can't contribute to your experience point, I guess your skill gain, until you're contributing to the story. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of different tools to use. But again, to go back to my original point, I think World of Darkness does need a lighter touch than they came from, or indeed probably the Cypher System games, which are quite open, and even more so than Chronicles of Darkness in the reward. They're sort of, I guess, what would the word be? The generosity of reward when it comes to failure. Numenera and The Strange and The Invisible Sun, it's you kind of want to lose and lose and lose. And while I don't see a problem with that, because those games work perfectly well with that system, I don't think that would work as well in World of Darkness, because I think people might game it a little too much. There needs to be a little more stagnancy is an awful word, but there still needs to be a little bit of stasis when it comes to character growth, because sometimes it's the story that needs to grow in place of character, or both at the same time in World of Darkness.
Yeah, those systems seem to create a sense of inevitability to progress and advancement, which doesn't necessarily thematically make sense. Some people do get stuck. On one end of the spectrum, you have Dungeons and Dragons, at least as of like second edition, where you literally only advance because you succeeded. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you have games where you literally only advance because of failure. And that maybe in Old World of Darkness, that failure is kind of part of the scenery, that some failures can be rewarded, but not all of them. And maybe in Old World of Darkness setting, you need to make it so those failures maybe have additional consequences. You did get beat to shit and you don't have a good way of recovering health correctly quickly. So you did get something, but you still quite literally have the scars from it.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's why in World of Darkness, I think it's more compatible almost with momentum than with beats or with experience for failure, because I prefer the immediate conversion of momentum into an effect that can affect this current scene than my character is stronger. I think experience and momentum should be, for World of Darkness, perhaps, be kept separate, because I like the idea of using momentum to justify where you managed to get that gun from, or justify why this villain is more ill than the storyteller had planned, or maybe has already run into a pack of werewolves before they came to you. It allows players to have direct influence over the direction of the story. Now, that's a dangerous brew in a way, because not all players are going to use that responsibly, but that all comes down to knowing your group and how much power to give the players.
And to some extent, this is a Mage the Ascension podcast, so chances are if you're listening to it, you're already pretty deep into that world. So if you do have a group of players and they are willing to allow you to test drive homebrew solutions, then maybe that is a group. But as a note to authors out there, I was delighted to discover that the rules of the Storyteller Vault says you are not allowed to mix settings across game families, so you can't introduce setting information from Old World of Darkness in New World of Darkness or Exalted and vice versa, but it specifically says you can take rules from it. So if you, like me, are interested in creating a guide to stunts in Mage or a guide to momentum in Mage, publish it, come on, talk to us about it, let's grow the options for the storytellers out there.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for your time. Are there any other projects you're working on or any other thoughts that you have regarding the state of Mage in Old World of Darkness, or what you would like to see from the community, or how the community can help shape maybe what M5 looks like?
Well, I have to be honest, I really adore the Mage the Ascension community, and I'm not involved in every single Discord group or forum to do with Mage, I'm sure, but I do keep an eye on the Mage the Ascension Facebook group, and I know they're going to hate me using the word consensus again, but there really does seem to be a consensus of optimism and positivity when it comes to Mage and their love of the game. And that's a wonderful thing to see, especially as I was there, Gandalf, when there were just constant edition wars. And because 20th anniversary has been out for quite a while now, and I think so many people are using it or have picked the parts from it that they wanted, which is the best way to use M20, the general mood seems to be very good. So my thanks to the community, any of you who listen to this, because you really wave the flag and make Mage the fantastic, accepting, welcoming game that it is. I couldn't be happier with you lot. In terms of, I guess, things to look forward to in terms of Mage, we obviously, anyone listening to this is probably going to know we've got Technocracy Reloaded, Victorian Mage, Book of the Fallen coming out. There may be more. Maybe more. We'll have to see. There are projects in the background rumbling away. We just need to get some boxes ticked. And that all comes down to schedule as well. When books are released, we know that we can't just release 4 Mage books a month anymore. Although, that said, I'm sure there's plenty of people listening who would love it if we did. The other projects I'm working on directly, I guess, the biggest one right now is probably Mummy the Curse, second edition, which is a Chronicles of Darkness game. I'm developing that one, and that will probably be on Kickstarter around the time this podcast goes up. And Mummy is a game for Chronicles of Darkness I've got a huge amount of affection for. It was my first paid assignment for Onyx Path to write for a Mummy the Curse sourcebook. And I just love the inversion of power. For anyone who is unfamiliar with Mummy, to put it simply, you wake up from your tomb, maybe a cult summoned you, maybe there was a great act of necromancy above you, or a war took place, and lots of blood was shed, and it woke you from your slumber. And when you wake up with godlike powers. You can hurl meteors from the sky, you can send out the 7 plagues of Egypt, you can do all kinds of horrible things. But you have very little memory, and that means you don't know where you're from. You may not even know your name, you don't know where you are now, and you don't necessarily know your purpose for awakening. All you know is that you are practically a deity, and you certainly have the powers to match. But very soon, your power level starts decreasing as your memory increases. And the end result is that you know everything by the time it's time to go back to sleep, but you no longer have the power to use to enact your will. And I love that. It's, again, a lovely inversion of the way power works in most RPGs. I think pretty much all RPGs, of course, because most of the time you are just getting more and more powerful, more and more potent. In Mummy, it's quite the reverse. You end up knowing everything, which means your character matches your player's knowledge. Maybe exceeds it, I guess. But you are a human, probably an old, withered, weakened human, increasingly dependent on their cult to perform their actions. So there's a lovely poetry to that, I think, especially one of my favorite one-shots to run for Mummy the Curse at conventions is the one where a Moret, that's essentially a group of mummies, wakes up. They can vaguely recall each other, and almost immediately as they're woken up because their tomb is being robbed. And they kill a bunch of the tomb robbers, they chase another bunch of them out, and they find these tomb robbers lead them to another Moret of mummies that seems to be recently woken. And so everyone's hurling these massive powers at each other, and so the one-shot goes on, this convention game, until you get to the point where the characters start to realize through deduction, through investigation, that the people they're fighting are friends, or were once friends or relatives from the time before they were turned into mummies. And that this loop of violence keeps happening. They might find an artifact that recalls the last time these two Morettes went to war. And that just before the time they're due to descend again, they remember everything. They know that they love each other, that they're friends with each other, that they were once allied together, and that fate just compels them to constantly war with each other. And they know for a fact that the next time they wake up, they're going to be destined to do the exact damn thing again. And so there becomes a desperate rush to make sure their cult can survive for the next few hundred years, so that the next time this happens, their cult might warn them beforehand, don't engage with this Moret, don't throw, you know, caution to the wind and cry havoc and all other good phrases. For the love of the judges, try peace for once. But you know, based on the way the system works, the way memory works, that that isn't going to be the case, and you'll wake up and tear another city apart. So Mummy is, as I say, it's on Kickstarter. It's a Chronicles of Darkness game. It's a really fantastic game for deep stories, unlike any you would tell, I think, for any other World of Darkness or Chronicles of Darkness game. So please do give it a look.
Wonderful. And you also made mention of the Came From. Is that still available on BackerKit?
As of time of recording, it is on BackerKit. I don't know how much longer it will be there, but please do look it up if you can. It's my pride and joy, I guess, because it's the game I conceptualized as well as develop it through to near release at this time. I'm seeing it being laid out now, and it is a beautiful book. So yeah, if humor, sci-fi, movies are your thing, and I love B-movies. I used to watch them so much when I was younger, and I still watch them now. The benefit of having an uncle with a whole office full of VHS cassettes of really crappy movies, and it's just what I grew up with. So yeah, getting to make them into an RPG was something special for me.
If nothing else, I am fascinated to see what I presume is a British man's view of Americana. That should be endlessly enjoyable to me in the same way that I love The Economist's snarky commentary on American politics. It really puts things in focus.
Yeah, well, you know, so this is an interesting thing to wrap up on, actually. And
I'm actually four small American children inside of a British three-piece suit. I'm on to you, Mr. Dawkins.
Specifically from the 1950s.
Exactly. The Little Rascals.
So the 1950s were obviously, in fact, no decade in America or the rest of the world has been perfect. And the 1950s, especially when you look at things like civil rights and the rights of gay people, the rights of women, rights in general weren't too great in the 1950s, and that was something really difficult to juggle for They Came From Beneath the Sea, because you have to show awareness when you're creating an historical game of what the world was like at the time, but you need to keep context in mind. Mm-hmm. Because while They Came From Beneath the Sea is set in the 1950s and the struggle for civil rights was definitely firing on all cylinders, and it was going to get even hotter as the decade went on, the drama, the horror of that experience for so many people is not something that can be trivialized with a B-movie, sci-fi, farcical game. So you have the option of, do you omit it entirely and just say it doesn't really fit into the game? Do you try and work it in and get accused of mishandling such a rightly sensitive subject? Or is there some middle ground? So it's a real struggle that I had with making a historical RPG, quite honestly, and hopefully people will be okay with the way that subject gets addressed in the game, and if they want to really focus in on that kind of thing when they run it, then I say please definitely go for it. You make the game into whatever you want it to be.
My mother was born in Belfast, so to me the 50s, I still have her ration books. Mm-hmm. So the idea of the infinite possibility of the future in the United States at that time, I find it important to remind people that, yes, there was infinite possibility for a small group in one country. The rest of the world was trying to recover from the most devastating war that had ever hit humanity. So I hope at some point in the future, much like we got Shards of the Exalted Dream or Mirrors for Chronicles of Darkness, that we get some analog that allows you to take the tools the game gives you and kind of maybe move them around. Let's cross our fingers. Maybe you decide to go native and suddenly we see this pop up on Storyteller Vault. Either way, I hope we get a lot of opportunity to see the way the baby you have given birth to develops possibly in many different directions. That was a terrible metaphor.
It was. It sounds quite Jimitsi in its evolution. Well, I can tell you this, that once They Came From comes out, almost definitely it will be on the StoryPath Nexus. Mm, and the StoryPath Nexus is the community content program that currently fields Scion, but will no doubt grow to cover games such as Trinity and They Came From Beneath the Sea, Dystopia Rising, Evolution. So yeah, keep your eyes open for that if you want to do a They Came From set or in a lovely sunny beachside resort in Britain. please do, or indeed the Russian perspective of it all. Stalin has been possessed by brain eater eel in They Came From Beneath the Sea, so he should be dead at the time the game is set, but something is still steering him, and it isn't terrestrial.
Well, and with that, if you've enjoyed this interview, please tell your friends about us. We're at madesthepodcast.com, at madesthepodcast on Twitter, and Mage the Podcast on just about every major podcatcher service. If you're curious about the show notes, and there will be copious ones, or would like more information about Matthew's Patreon or his other projects, I will put all of those within our show notes, madesthepodcast.com. If you would like to become an executive producer and help make these episodes possible, please click on the link that says support us on our page. And with that, Matthew, thank you so much for your time. This has been an utter delight.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.